The Sherwin-Williams Summer Sale is here. Get 30% off select paints and stains or 35% off our newest product, Emerald Symmetry, July 17th through the 27th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
There's George Smiley and Jason Bourne, Austin Powers and Ethan Hunt, Maxwell Smart and Emma Peel, and of course, James Bond. Secrets, lies, and a license to kill make for great stories, so it's no wonder books, film, and TV have been littered with secret agents. Good spy story has all the right ingredients: suspense and action, high stakes and plot twists, moral conundrums, and complex characters. As for me, I love a good spy story, even more when they resemble reality. So while I love the spectacle of the dashing, tuxedoed leading man blowing up the villain's lair, I think I prefer the pensive, quiet, forbidding, intense narrative of the more real-life spy. The unlikely hero, riddled with doubt and paranoia, but still driven by purpose, whether that's some moral code, patriotism, or just greed or ego. That's the sort of story we're bringing you today, and it can't be more close to reality because it's all true. The American Sons Turned Soviet Spies is an episode from the podcast True Life Spy Stories, and I hope you enjoy. While you're listening, be sure to search for and follow True Life Spy Stories. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you.
Insurance isn't one size fits all. That's why drivers have enjoyed Progressive's Name Your Price tool for years now. With the Name Your Price tool, you tell them what you want to pay, and they'll show you options that fit your budget. So whether you're picking out your first policy or just looking for something that works better for you and your family, they make it easy to see your options. Visit Progressive.com. Find a rate that works for you with the Name Your Price tool. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm not a professional spy, and I'm not a professional anything. I'm an amateur at everything I do, or else I wouldn't be here right now, sitting here in this prison.
What you did has been described as the greatest security breach in decades.
Serves them right.
Serves them right.
It's my feeling on it. I have no regrets.
The 9-mile stretch of coastline in Southern California, known as Palos Verdes, is home to some of the wealthiest Los Angeles families. It is hardly the place you would expect a true Cold War spy thriller to be born. Yet it was here that childhood friends Christopher John Boyce and Andrew Dalton Lee would meet and move on from their privileged upbringings to betray their country. Together, they plunged headfirst into the dangerous world of espionage. Their story, a blend of misplaced idealism, greed, hedonism, and recklessness, would ultimately expose a shocking breach of national security and leave a lasting mark on the annals of Cold War history. This is the tale of the Falcon and the Snowman. The eldest of nine siblings, Christopher John Boyce was born on the 16th of February 1953. He grew up in a household where patriotism and Catholicism were pillars of daily life. His father, Charles Boyce, was a former FBI agent who had transitioned to corporate security in the aerospace industry. Chris excelled academically, testing with an IQ of 142, and showed natural leadership, winning election as his 8th grade class president. But it was his passion for falconry that truly defined young Chris. His father had given him a book on the subject, and after a family friend who owned a falcon gave him a flying demonstration, Chris was hooked. By age 14, he had earned certification as a master falconer, spending countless hours in the rugged canyons around Palos Verdes trapping and training birds of prey. Andrew Dalton Lee, on the other hand, entered this world through different circumstances. Born on the 3rd of January 1952, he was adopted by Dr. Dalton Bradley Lee, a successful pathologist and decorated World War II pilot, and his wife Anne. Andrew preferred going by Dalton after his adoptive father. Unlike Chris, Dalton struggled academically and socially. He seemed to stop growing in fifth grade, leaving him at just 5'2" tall, with severe acne compounding his insecurities during his teenage years. Where Chris naturally commanded respect, Dalton fought for attention through increasingly desperate means as the years went on. The two boys met as altar servers at St. John Fisher Catholic Church, and their friendship grew stronger during high school at Palos Verdes High, where they both played football for the C team. What truly cemented their friendship was their shared love of birds of prey. One day, Dalton showed off the owls, hawks, and falcons he kept at home near to the family putting green, as one does, and it was from that point that Chris and Dalton became best friends. But as the 1960s gave way to the 1970s, the social upheaval transforming America began to crack the foundation of their privileged world. The Vietnam War and Watergate scandal created fissures in American society that reached even into Palos Verdes' insulated community. Chris, initially a fervent supporter of the war effort, began questioning everything he had been taught about American righteousness. Trips to rural Mexico with his family exposed him to grinding poverty that starkly contrasted with his comfortable upbringing. The cognitive dissonance was jarring for a young man raised on absolute moral imperatives. Dalton's rebellion took a more direct path, through drugs. Southern California's high schools were awash with marijuana and even cocaine in the early 1970s, and Dalton embraced both enthusiastically. The drugs offered him something he had never possessed: social currency. Girls who had ignored the short, awkward teenager with bad skin suddenly sought him out when he offered free samples. By his senior year, Dalton had discovered that drug dealing provided not just attention and sexual favors, but serious money. Chris's grades suffered under Dalton's influence, dropping from superior to mediocre. Concerned parents transferred him to Rolling Hills High School, hoping distance would break the friendship's destructive dynamic. But their bond, forged in the wilderness with hawks and falcons, proved stronger than parental intervention. After graduation, both young men drifted. Dalton dropped out of junior college within months, fully embracing drug dealing as his profession. By 1973, he was moving significant quantities of marijuana and cocaine, earning between $1,000 and $2,000 weekly, and his reputation grew as someone connected to serious dealers in Mexico. Chris struggled to find direction. Mononucleosis, or glandular fever, delayed his college entry, and he bounced between three different institutions. He briefly considered entering the priesthood, but after a year spent at Loyola University in 1972, he suffered a spiritual crisis of belief and dropped out. When a federal grant to study the history of falconry at California Polytechnic State University was rejected, even his passion seemed to offer no clear path forward. By the start of 1974, Chris was floundering. In June of that year, his father, Charles Boyce, used his aerospace industry connections to secure his son a temporary job at TRW, a major defense contractor based in Redondo Beach. Chris viewed it as stopgap employment while he figured out his future. Starting as a general clerk at $140 per week, his intelligence and work ethic left his supervisors suitably impressed. By August, Chris was being considered for upgraded responsibilities requiring secret security clearance. Background checks revealed no red flags, his admitted occasional marijuana use not being enough to raise alarm. Unknown to Chris at the time, he was being prepared for assignment to one of America's most closely guarded secrets. The Rhyolite system was a network of sophisticated surveillance satellites designed to electronically gather intelligence from space. These black satellites could eavesdrop on telephone conversations, intercept microwave transmissions, and photograph military installations with extraordinary clarity. Their primary targets were missile launch sites in China and the Soviet Union. While he remained a private contractor employee of TRW, his salary was to be paid by the CIA. Chris's new workplace was called the Black Vault, a secured communications centre linking TRW with CIA headquarters in Langley and Pine Gap, a joint Australian-US satellite surveillance and intelligence base near Alice Springs in Australia. Each morning, he would navigate multiple security checkpoints, deactivate alarms, and unlock safes containing daily cipher codes for encrypted teletype machines. His responsibilities included processing overnight messages from Langley and distributing copies to specific TRW and CIA officials. One of the first things to shock Chris when he started his new role was the casual security within this highly classified environment. He saw his colleagues regularly smuggle alcohol into the facility in briefcases, treating the vaults, in his words, like a non-stop cocktail lounge. But it was the content of the communications that truly disturbed Chris. He discovered the CIA was actively infiltrating Australian labour unions and agitating against the left-leaning Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, funding opposition parties to oust him from power. Most shocking for Chris was learning that much of the intelligence gathered was being deliberately withheld from Australia, despite agreements that all satellite intelligence would be shared with the Australian government. TRW was even designing a newer, more sophisticated satellite system called Argus, about which the Australians were to be told nothing. Why was the CIA looking to interfere in Australian politics? In short, the US didn't like the cuts of Gough Whitlam's left-leaning jib. Whitlam had withdrawn Australian troops from Vietnam and publicly criticised the American bombings of Hanoi in 1973. There was a concern that Gough Whitlam's government might expose the true function of the secret US bases in Australia, which at that point in time had never been publicly acknowledged. Pine Gap was vital to US intelligence gathering operations, and they could not risk Whitlam terminating the agreement to operate it. There was also a worry that a left-wing government would be easier to penetrate by the KGB. What's more, the spy satellites weren't just targeting Cold War adversaries like China and the USSR, but were also surveilling American allies, including Israel, Japan, and France. Chris believed this went too far and couldn't be justified as protecting US national security. The corporate military intelligence complex that served as his work environment, to him, reeked of hypocrisy and senseless nationalism. For a young man already disillusioned by events like the war in Vietnam and Watergate, what he considered as the betrayal of US allies and treaty obligations felt like a moral corruption at the heart of American power. Chris's disillusionment deepened through 1974 and early 1975. At weekend parties, his tongue loosened by alcohol and cocaine, he began sharing details about his work with Dalton. He spoke of the CIA's deceptions, the lax security in the Black Vault, and his growing contempt for the entire operation. Meanwhile, Dalton's legal and financial troubles were mounting. His $500-a-week drug habits had resulted in multiple arrests. He had violated his probation conditions many times, and he was facing the possibility of serious prison time. One evening, Chris made a fateful suggestion to Dalton. Why not sell classified information to a foreign government? The idea emerged from Chris's desire to wage what he would later call a one-man war against the government he had come to despise. For him, it was a form of protest, a way to strike back at the system's hypocrisy. For Dalton, dollar signs must have appeared in his eyes. He thought this could be the windfall he needed to solve his drug and legal problems. Yet Dalton could hardly believe what his longtime friend was suggesting. Espionage was a little more serious than a bit of dope slinging. But as his court date approached and prison loomed, the idea gained appeal. In early April of 1975, just days before his scheduled court hearing, Dalton fled to Mexico City. With that, the spy games began. Dalton's approach to Soviet intelligence in April of 1975 was rather direct. He simply walked into the Soviet embassy, announced he had top-secret information about American spy satellites, and demanded to speak with someone in charge. A few minutes later, he sat across from KGB agent Vasily Ivanovich Okana. Having been coached by Chris, Dalton presented himself as a courier for an anonymous US government employee with socialist leanings. As proof of his access, He provided computer cards and teletype material from TRW's encryption systems that Chris had smuggled out of the facility. O'Connor, initially skeptical, seemed impressed by Dalton's basic technical knowledge. They arranged a follow-up meeting, and Dalton left with $250 to cover his expenses. That evening, Dalton called Chris from a phone booth in Hermosa Beach. Their plan was taking shape and was now something real. Through the remainder of 1975 and into 1976, a steady stream of classified material flowed from Chris's position in the Black Vault to Dalton's Soviet contacts in Mexico City. Cipher cards, copies of Rhyolite messages, and technical documents changed hands for increasingly substantial payments. The Soviets provided Dalton with an elaborate system for scheduling meetings, using postcards and adhesive tape marks on lampposts at Mexico City intersections. To avoid his mounting legal troubles, Dalton acquired a false identity as Theodore Philip Love Lance, using a deceased person's information to obtain a California driver's license. This allowed him to travel freely between Mexico and the USA, while technically a fugitive from American justice. As the operation matured, Soviet demands ramped up. They wanted satellite transmission frequencies and photographs of the Rhyolite and Argus payloads. The actual satellite hardware containing the sophisticated electronic surveillance equipment that made the spy satellites so valuable. These payloads housed the sensitive receivers, transmitters, and photographic equipment that allowed the satellites to intercept communications and capture detailed imagery from space. In March of 1976, Dalton traveled to Vienna for advanced espionage training. During this trip, the Soviets provided him with specialized photography equipment and training in covert communication techniques. Despite their professional instruction, the photographs Dalton subsequently provided were consistently poor quality, often blurry images of irrelevant subjects or, embarrassingly, nude women he had photographed for personal reasons. While his handlers remained optimistic about the partnership's potential, cracks were already starting to show. Fueled by alcohol and cocaine during the Vienna meetings, Dalton drunkenly revealed Christopher Boyce's full name to Muzenkov. Meanwhile, Chris grew increasingly frustrated with what he suspected was Dalton's financial manipulation. Dalton was keeping roughly $4 for every dollar he handed back to Chris, using most of the money to fuel his growing heroin addiction. By late 1976, the partnership was deteriorating rapidly. Chris, viewing the secrets he stole more as tools of protest rather than profit, was disgusted by Dalton's greed and recklessness. Frustrated with his unreliable partner, Chris bypassed Dalton entirely and established direct communication with the KGB. The Soviets were not pleased with the direct approach, and with Chris taking it upon himself to cut their courier out of the picture. The confrontation came to a head in October of 1976 when Chris insisted on accompanying Dalton to Mexico City. At the Soviet embassy, they were escorted to a basement meeting room where the two Americans were initially welcomed with drinks and apparent enthusiasm. But things turned sour when Chris had to explain that it was an impossible task to obtain the satellite frequencies requested by the Soviets. That information was held by the NSA and Western Union, not TRW. The mood of the KGB officers darkened considerably. As Dalton, who was in his usual intoxicated state, started to complain about the condo in Puerto Vallarta that had been promised to him, one of the KGB officers placed a pistol on the table. Clearly, the Soviets had had enough, and the message was unmistakable. When Dalton left the room, Chris delivered the killing blow to their partnership. He told the KGB that Dalton was a heroin addict and had even threatened to expose their operation to Chris's FBI father. It was then agreed that it was necessary to cut Dalton out of the picture completely. The KGB made a proposition that revealed the true scope of their ambitions for Chris. They were thinking long term. They wanted Chris to quit his job at TRW, enroll in university with Soviet funding, and eventually seek employment with the CIA or State Department. He would become a ready-made mole, potentially providing intelligence for decades. From his position seated in a dimly lit room in the basement of the Soviet embassy in Mexico, it was a deal Chris could hardly refuse, even if he wanted to. And so Christopher Boyce returned to California and began preparing his University of California Riverside application. He focused on courses that would position him for intelligence or foreign service careers. Before leaving TRW in mid-December 1976, he stole a large file on Project Pyramida, a proposed satellite system marked top secret but carelessly left in an unsecured cabinet. These documents were to be Chris's farewell gift to the Soviets before transitioning to his new role as a deep cover sleeper asset. After the October meeting in Mexico City, Dalton had returned to Mazatlan. When he attempted to schedule another meeting in early November, placing the agreed-upon marks on Mexico City lampposts, no Soviet handler appeared. Ignoring all previous warnings about embassy security, Dalton walked directly into the Soviet compound, demanding to see his KGB handler, Boris Gish. Gish was furious. He called Dalton's material worthless and labeled him a fool for disobeying explicit instructions. Two chauffeurs dragged the protesting American into a limousine and deposited him on a cobblestone street miles away from the embassy. The message couldn't have been clearer, but Dalton was persistent, if nothing else. Against his better judgment, Chris agreed to have Dalton act as courier one final time so that he could sell the Project Pyramida documents to the Soviets. Dalton must have been ecstatic. He believed the information could fetch as much as $75,000 from the Soviets, enough cash to pay for a one-way ticket to Costa Rica and to start a new life far away from his legal troubles. With his court hearing scheduled for the 20th of January 1977, the stage was set for the final act of this amateur hour espionage drama. On the morning of the 6th of January 1977, Andrew Dalton Lee walked casually toward the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. What he didn't know was that Mexican police had intensified their watch of the embassy following the murder of a policeman by a Mexican Marxist terrorist group the week prior. At 11 a.m., Dalton casually tossed an object through the embassy's security gate. Surveillance officers immediately surrounded him, demanding explanations in rapid Spanish. Initially, Dalton's practiced charm seemed to work. He apologized in broken Spanish and English, claiming he was merely littering. A U.S. diplomat emerged who, recognizing the man as an American, called the U.S. embassy to assist. But then Dalton's frantic gestures dislodged a partially smoked marijuana joint from his clothing. Any hope of his day improving immediately evaporated. Dalton was taken to a Mexico City police station where his real nightmare began. Believing that they had a terror suspect on their hands, the hours of interrogation turned to days and the methods of questioning became increasingly more brutal. By the third day of beatings and sleep deprivation, Dalton finally cracked. He confessed his espionage activities and named his partner in crime, Chris. He claimed that they were part of a CIA disinformation operation, a weak attempt to save his skin and position himself as a patriotic American rather than a traitor. Instead of pursuing charges locally, Mexican officials decided to deport Dalton. A week later, three FBI agents were waiting at Los Angeles International Airport to receive him. During processing at FBI headquarters, Dalton was presented with a typed confession based on the statements he made to Mexican police. Still hoping his CIA cover story might offer some protection, he signed the documents detailing meeting locations, materials passed, and payments received. Armed with this confession, FBI agents immediately planned Christopher Boyce's arrest. What had begun as a simple drug bust had exposed one of the most serious intelligence breaches in American Cold War history. For Dalton, now facing potential espionage charges carrying the death penalty, the reality was sinking in. His talent for talking his way out of trouble had finally failed him completely. On the 16th of January 1977, FBI agents surrounded Christopher Boyce's isolated house on a turkey ranch in rural Riverside County. They arrested him without incidents as he returned from a falcon trapping expedition. At FBI headquarters in Los Angeles, Chris also gave a confession. He described the lax security at TRW, his political disillusionment, and Dalton's role in the conspiracy. He described Dalton as a hoodlum who had cheated and lied to him, while describing himself merely as an adventurer. The arrests, of course, made national headlines, creating public bewilderment about how two young men from such privileged backgrounds could choose Soviet espionage as their life's path. Within 2 weeks, both faced federal indictment on 8 counts of espionage and conspiracy. Armed with the confessions, the case should have been open and shut, but unfortunately that proved not to be the case. Dalton maintained that he was acting as a CIA subcontractor in a disinformation campaign. Whereas Chris said that he had been blackmailed by Dalton, who threatened to expose him to his FBI father. After failed plea bargaining, the matter had to proceed to trial. It was here that the US government faced a dilemma. Obtaining convictions meant potentially revealing highly sensitive intelligence about satellite operations that had never been publicly acknowledged. It was ultimately decided to proceed using only portions of the Pyramida documents as examples of the thousands of items stolen from TRW. Both trials followed similar patterns. Christopher Boyce was convicted on the 28th of April 1977 after less than 4 hours of jury deliberation. Andrew Dalton Lee's conviction followed on the 12th of May. At just 24 years of age, Christopher Boyce received 40 years in federal prison. Andrew Dalton Lee was sentenced to life imprisonment. Shockwaves were felt throughout Australian politics and American intelligence after the public learned of the Falcon and the Snowman affair. In Australia, Prime Minister Gough Whitlam's decision to publicly reveal the existence of the previously secret US listening stations and the CIA funding of opposition groups created what observers called political pandemonium. His transparency may have contributed to his dramatic removal from office by Governor John Kerr, while Boyce's trial testimony about US manipulation of Australian labour unions sparked investigative journalism that turned into a political tornado. This ultimately forced both governments to renegotiate their agreements about American bases on Australian soil. For the United States, the damage was even more severe. The CIA was forced to make its first public admission of involvement in clandestine satellite operations, and intelligence officials privately acknowledged this as among the worst breaches in CIA history. This was the first time that the KGB had actually penetrated American surveillance satellite operations. The fallout prompted sweeping security reforms. TRW implemented buddy system protocols in their Black Vault, the CIA launched surprise inspections at defense contractors, and the agency accelerated development of more advanced eavesdropping satellites. Meanwhile, the Soviets began encoding their missile test signals, effectively blinding American intelligence to crucial military data. What had started as two young men's betrayal had fundamentally altered the intelligence landscape, giving Soviet intelligence intimate knowledge of America's most sensitive satellite programs, while forcing a complete overhaul of how the US protected its most closely guarded secrets. Chris's incarceration began at Terminal Island Federal Correctional Institution in Los Angeles Harbor while he was still awaiting sentencing. Confined to an 8x5-foot cell in maximum security for 24 hours daily, he spent his time reading history and doing 1,200 push-ups per day, but his mind consumed itself with thoughts of escape. He was later transferred to Lompoc Federal Penitentiary, where his plans to escape started to take shape. He noticed a critical security flaw at the prison grounds. There was a point within the secure holding area between the Sallyport's inner and outer gates that was fenced by only a single layer of chain link. If he were able to scale that section of fence, he could mostly avoid the lethal alley of razor wire coils and make his escape. Inspired by the Clint Eastwood film Escape from Alcatraz, which, believe it or not, was shown during a prison recreation night, Chris planned his breakout. He fashioned a papier-mâché head in art class, which he planned to use to fool evening headcounts by apathetic night guards. With the help of his cellmate, Billy, he secured a job on the maintenance crew for exterior access, and in the full light of day and under the watchful gaze of prison guards, was able to dig a shallow passage in a sump drain near the perimeter fence. On the 21st of January 1980, Christopher Boyce emerged from the drainage ditch long after lights out. There he had been hiding in wait for hours after the last evening headcount. His legs ached from the hours he spent in the small cramped hole. He managed to scale the chain-link fence and, using the gardening shears he had stolen from the prison's equipment shack, cut through the razor wire blocking his path. He then dropped 10 feet to his freedom, exhausted but clear of the prison perimeter. His absence that night, as he disappeared into the dark wilderness, went unnoticed. Overnight, Boyce became the U.S. Marshal's most wanted fugitive. For the next 19 months, Boyce lived in the wilderness of Southern California, using skills learned during falconry expeditions to survive. He was eventually able to reach northern Idaho, where he found work at a tree farm near Bonner's Ferry, using the fake name Jim Namchek. But this meager existence proved insufficient for someone accustomed to comfort and ready cash. By mid-1980, Chris had embarked on a new criminal career, this time as a bank robber. He met up with a former fellow inmate, Calvin Robinson, and together with brothers James and Joseph Pratt, the gang robbed as many as 16 banks across Washington and Idaho. The ultimate goal for Chris remained defection to the Soviet Union. In early 1981, he purchased a half interest in a fishing boat, hoping to sail across the Bering Strait. When the small vessel proved not to be seaworthy, he moved to Port Angeles in Washington and began taking flying lessons, believing that he could pilot a plane to Soviet territory. Christopher Boyce's luck finally ran out on the 21st of August 1981. James Pratt, feeling shortchanged by the distribution of the stolen money from the bank heists, contacted the FBI hoping for reward money. After a two-week manhunt, U.S. Marshals spotted Chris alone in his car at the Pit Stop Burger Joint in Port Angeles. He was soon surrounded by federal agents with drawn weapons and made no attempt to escape or resist. And so it was back to the slammer for Chris, who pleaded guilty to 5 bank robberies, although he certainly committed many more, and received a mandatory minimum of 28 years, on top of his original 40-year espionage sentence. Once back behind bars, Chris was attacked by white supremacist inmates at Leavenworth, leading to his transfer to the ultra-restrictive Marion Federal Penitentiary, where he spent years in complete isolation. In 1985, his testimony before a Senate subcommittee investigating security clearances earned him some concessions, including limited recreation time. The key to both men's eventual freedom was activist Kathleen Kate Mills. She had read their story and chose to dedicate nearly 2 decades of her life to securing their release. Her efforts, combined with a remarkable intervention by the original sentencing judge, Robert Kelleher, led to Dalton's parole in 1998 after serving 21 years. Christopher Boyce was paroled on the 15th of March 2003 after serving approximately 25 years in federal prison. In October 2002, he married Kate Mills. While prosecutors at the time argued that it represented one of the most damaging conspiracies in US history, it was revealed in a 1997 Russian security memo that the information Boyce and Lee had provided was so worthless that there was not even a file in current Russian archives. As it turned out, Project Pyramida had been shelved 3 years prior to the documents being stolen and was no longer being funded. In total, Andrew Dalton Lee received $60,000 from the Soviets, whereas Christopher Boyce only took home $15,000 and a small amount of cocaine. Today, both men live quietly in retirement. Andrew Dalton Lee managed to kick his drug habit while in prison and became a certified dental technician, but has never expressed any true remorse for what he did, not even for his drug dealing. He briefly worked as Sean Penn's assistant following the release of the 1985 film The Falcon and the Snowman that told his and Boyce's story. Today he keeps a low profile living in Southern California. Christopher Boyce, off parole since 2008, lives in Oregon and has appeared on various TV interviews and occasionally posts on social media about his Falcons. Time seems to have tempered his once unapologetic stance. Boyce acknowledged his naivety in choosing to wage a one-man war against the might of U.S. intelligence and expressed regret for his actions, in particular the bank robberies which he described as unconscionable. The tale of the Falcon and the Snowman reveals the stark contrast between the two spies. The one motivated, he said, by idealistic disillusionment, the other driven cynically by money and drugs. Some today put Christopher Boyce in the same category as more recent leakers like Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning. You can make up your own mind as to whether people like these are heroes, traitors, or both.